Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 31st of May, 2023, and it's Taylor and Bishop here with another episode of Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast. I'm David Taylor, and he's Phil Bishop. How are you doing, Phil?
I'm very well, David. How are you this morning?
I'm very well indeed, yes. Yes, nice to see that the weather has cheered up a little bit down here. So I'm feeling far more summery than I did last time.
It's still a bit fresh here in Kent, but bright as well.
Good.
Anyway, let's crack on, because we've got a lot to get through this morning.
Yeah, we have indeed.
Can I just start off with a new construction celebration that I became aware of, the press release that I got this week. It was sent to me by, I don't know if it came from McAlpine or Vinci, but it relates to their IHP, Integrated Health Partners, joint venture that builds hospitals. And hospitals and celebrations are going to be a bit of a theme of our conversation today. Hopefully it all works and we can all segue it together nicely. But this actual press release is put out by NHS York and Scarborough Teaching Hospitals, the NHS Foundation Trust. And it relates to, I call it A&E, but they call it Urgent and Emergency Care Centre, okay, being built at Scarborough Hospital. And it's quite a big project, £47 million job. And they have just held what they call a watertight event.
Interesting.
Watertight event. Yeah. And it's a celebration of the fact that the building is now watertight and they can get on, you know, move on to fitting it out and doing, the job's not finished, but it's achieved a significant milestone, which the client and the contracting team wanted to celebrate. It's an important milestone. We've done it. They don't say whether it's on time and on budget, but let's give them the benefit of the doubt and assume that it is and all's going well. And so they're holding a watertight event. Now, I've heard of groundbreaking events.
Yeah.
And topping out events. And occasionally steel signing events. But have you ever heard of a watertight event?
No, I mean, it must be the same as a topping out ceremony. Because a topping out ceremony is when you reach the highest point of the building. It's not necessarily finished, but it's watertight, one assumes, because obviously the roof must be completed. So, no, never heard of that. Although I did, when you alerted me to this, I did do a little bit of research, and my research comprised solely of going on Wikipedia and looking up topping out. And you mentioned this thing about painting, signing steel beams, which apparently seems to be an American thing. The last beam of a skyscraper is painted white and signed by all the workers. But apparently in New Zealand, they have something, and this is far closer to the watertight ceremony. It says, in New Zealand, completion of the roof to a waterproof state is celebrated through a roof shout, where workers are treated to cake and beer, which I think sounds like a very, very civilised ceremony. But that's not unique to New Zealand, because the Dutch have something similar. The tradition of pannenbier, which literally means tile beer. And it's popular in the Low Countries. And when the building has reached the highest point, they put the city flag up there, and it stays in place until the building's owner provides free beer to the workers, after which it is lowered. So that's another good idea. And then the other one, which is, again, the closest I could find to a waterproof ceremony, is I think it comes from South Africa, which is strange place for something like this to originate, but it's called a roof wetting ceremony. And I found this on a quite random search. It was a project in California, but they say that the practice originated in South Africa. It's a roof wetting ceremony. When the building is watertight, they pour a ceremonial bottle of rum over the roof to celebrate it.
What a waste.
Yeah, what a waste. But so that my rather shallow research did turn up those examples, but no, that's the first time I've ever heard of a watertight ceremony. Good on them. I don't know if anybody got any rum or beer out of it, but Maybe they could tell us.
Let's come back to that subject of the rights and wrongs of having beer or rum in the workplace, particularly on site.
Sure.
We can come back to that.
Yes.
Now, there was an announcement last week from the government that they were rejigging the hospital building programme. Headline on the government's press release, 5 major hospitals to be rebuilt as part of £20 billion new hospital infrastructure investment.
And it
all sounds great until you remember that it's not that long ago. It's about two prime ministers ago that we were going to get 40 new hospitals by 2030. You thought, blimey, this is fantastic. And then it emerges that a new hospital might not be a new hospital. It might be a new wing or a refurbished wing or something. And one of these new hospitals has been under construction since Carillion was around.
Bloody hell.
I mean, it's just the Midland Met Hospital in Sandwell. I mean, they're saying, oh, yeah, we've got a hospital under construction. Isn't this great news, folks? You think, well, no, that should have been finished ages ago. So it's great that money's being spent on construction. It's great that money's being spent on hospitals. But the government is trying terribly hard to spin this as something other than really pretty grotty failure at getting things moving as quickly as it promised.
I mean, it was Boris Johnson, one of Boris Johnson's key election promises in 2019, the general election, which he won very decisively, that he was going to build 40 hospitals. And almost immediately, people started to pick away at the fabric of his election pledges and realise that it would all come unravelled quite quickly. I mean, I think earlier this year, there was a confirmation that only 10 of the projects that he had originally mentioned even had planning permission, let alone were actually being built. And now we know that they're starting work on 5, which isn't really very impressive when you compare it to the 40 originally mooted. They've got this new, I haven't looked into this, but apparently all new hospitals are going to be built to a new standardised design. Did you know about this? Hospital 2.0?
Yes, I don't know exactly what the design looks like, but it's not entirely surprising. And they went through this, or they tried to go through this with the school building as well. My only slight concern, I mean, what's interesting is that they're bringing forward the reinforced autoclaved aerated concrete.
Yes.
Concrete aero bars.
That's right.
And that they're all crumbling, falling apart in schools and hospitals. And they're bringing forward the hospitals for rebuilding that are most suffering from crumbling RAAC.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that, of course, was the modern method of construction of its day.
Yes.
They're getting rid of the hospitals which are full of this crumbling concrete and using new forms of modern methods of construction. So whatever the latest thing is, yep, we'll use it, even if it means we're going to have to start all over again in 30 years' time.
Well, yeah, it's a very cynical view, Phil, but I mean, you have a point. RAAC, which, what does it stand for? Reinforced aerated something.
Autoclaved. I know what reinforced and aerated means. I actually don't know what autoclaved means. I keep using this word.
I think it's, you put it in an oven. You put it in an oven and heat it up. But, this was a problem which emerged relatively recently, if I'm correct. We talked about it a month or two ago, didn't we? That it's not just hospitals. A lot of schools have also got ceiling roofs, roof structures made out of this stuff. And it is very crumbly. And once the rebar starts to rust, the whole thing begins to crumble. So, yeah, the 5 hospitals that I mentioned earlier are the ones which are most badly affected by the presence of these crumbling RAAC roof panels, mainly, and wall panels as well. So they've got to do something about that anyway. I mean, forget 40 new hospitals by 2030. They were going to have to do something about these hospitals anyway, because you can't have the roofs falling in on a hospital ward or an operating theatre. So, yeah, those 5 hospitals, they're going to be number one priority, and so they should be.
So do we know, David, which are the, or can you tell us which are the hospitals which are going to be rebuilt or expanded or getting a new wing first?
Yes, I have a list, so I can read it out to you. It's the Airedale Hospital in West Yorkshire. I don't know whereabouts in West Yorkshire
Near Keighley.
Near Keighley.
Between Keighley and Skipton.
Okay, right, okay. The Queen Elizabeth King's Lynn Hospital in Norfolk, Hinchingbrook in Cambridgeshire, Mid Cheshire, Leighton in Cheshire, and Frimley Park in Surrey. Those are the hot spots. Those are the ones with the RAAC crumbling. So those will get first dibs when it comes to this expenditure. And hopefully, I don't know if they're just going to do the repairs or whether they're going to extend or expand or improve these hospitals in other ways. But it'll be the crumbling concrete which gets the first amount of expenditure. Obviously, hospitals leads us on very neatly to our next topic, which is, of course, is health and safety, and that's a very serious topic, of course, and one that we return to quite regularly. But the guardian of health and safety in this country is, of course, a health and safety executive. They're the people who go on site inspections and all the rest of it, and prosecute people when working practices are deemed inadequate and break the law. But apparently, their remit doesn't go enough, and this is a story which broke, I think, last week when the Unite Union called on the government to extend the HSE's remit beyond safety, so, you know, trips and, you know, falls and that sort of thing, and health, which is occupational health, dust and asbestos and all that, to mental health. They say the HSE should also be responsible for effectively policing mental health in the workplace, and with particular emphasis on, of course, the apparently increasing incidence of suicide in the workplace, or work-related suicides, which is an interesting one because, as far as I was aware, the HSE already did touch upon that sort of thing. The HSE's remit, and I got this off the HSE website, is that it prevents work-related death, injury and ill health. And it already looks at things like stress at work. It has a stress indicator tool, which you can use to find out if you're stressed. And I think this is probably where Unite are focusing, because the HSE admits that it isn't actually in charge of policing things like mental health and bullying and things like that. But it will offer advice on how to spot the signs, how to tackle the problem and this sort of thing. I think the union wants the HSE to actually start investigating. When somebody commits suicide, they want the HSE to find out if there was something to do with their work environment that contributed to it.
Well, this hasn't come out of nowhere. Unite, when it put out its statement calling for the widening of the HSE's remit in this way, it was responding actually to an article in the British Medical Journal,
right,
which was calling specifically for all suicides of teachers to be investigated by the HSE, because this was all prompted by the death of the suicide of a teacher called Ruth Perry, mm-hmm. who was a head teacher who was stressed and anguished by an Ofsted inspection. And there's been a lot of publicity about the way in which Ofsted inspections can be notoriously unnuanced and just simply, you know, a one word failing or poor or something can put enormous stress and pressure on head teachers. And this has generated a lot of press coverage, which I'm sure most, if not all, of our listeners have been exposed to the press coverage of this. And Unite is saying, look, it's not just head teachers. It's all workplace, work-related suicides, not a suicide in the workplace itself, but a work-related suicide should be investigated by the HSE. Mm. And as you say, I wasn't quite aware of the work the HSE has done in the sphere of mental health, but I'm not aware of it, of investigating any work-related suicides. Mm. And it is, as has been increasingly reported in the past few years, a growing issue in construction. But I think the difficulty for anyone, the HSE or anyone, in investigating a suicide is that it seems to me that while there may be a trigger event, whether that be an Ofsted inspection, or it might be workplace bullying or threat of being sacked, or whatever. Mm-hmm. My, and I have, I have no great, I'm treading carefully because I don't claim any expertise, but it just seems to me likely that if someone is driven to end their own life, there's almost certainly going to be a combination of factors at work. And whether you can say that it's purely 100% work related, and then breaking that down to, okay, what percentage of that is down to work and what percentage of that is down to home life difficulties or family difficulties or, you know, relationships with one's parents or one's children or any other, you know, stuff that's going on in your life, which has got nothing to do with work, which makes your work life less bearable, less tolerable. There are things which many people put up with and shoulder at work and just get on and knuckle down and do the job, which someone who's been made fragile by other things may not be able to tolerate them quite so well.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean to say that construction or any employer or any workplace should get a free pass. They should be investigated.
Yeah.
But I don't quite know what conclusions they could reach.
Well, I suppose, I think you're absolutely right. I can't imagine that somebody is, if they had a happy and fulfilling family life, that their work alone would be enough to push them over the edge. And again, like you, you know, I'm no expert in this, but this is just me supposing. But I suppose that the HSE, you know, they could at least look into the environment in that person's workplace and find out perhaps the extent to which conditions there might have contributed. And as you say, it might be a combination of factors, and just one thing triggers that decision to make somebody want to take their own life. And if they find out that it could have been bullying or unfair treatment or overwork or lack of oversight in the workplace which actually provided that trigger, then maybe they, you know, there's something that they can do to remove that factor from other people's working environments.
I think that's absolutely right. I agree with that.
That's all I think they can do.
I think it's worth investigating, worth the HSE investigating, whether there are anything in statistics which needs further investigation. If, for example, you know, we know that the work done by a professor at Glasgow Caledonian University has drilled the numbers down and found that, you know, it's disproportionately the trades and the construction labourers rather than the construction professionals who are more likely to commit suicide, from the construction industry statistics, that is.
Yeah.
What I don't know is whether there are any companies particularly associated, whether you know, any particular type of construction site, whether it's house building more than civil engineering, infrastructure projects. I would actually suspect infrastructure projects might be more.
Yeah, I would, yeah.
I think because there's more remote working and more peripatetic, we've talked about before, I suspect. I've no evidence to support that. I mean, I'm thinking of, there was it 20 years ago now, I guess, there was a barracks, an army barracks for young soldiers, for cadets, that was particularly, had a high incidence of suicides and incidents, and that was investigated. There was something wrong with the culture that needed sorting. I think they shut it down in the end.
Yes.
So and similarly, if there's a, you know, a prison or a borstal where there's a much higher number of suicides than others, you would expect the relevant authority to say, right, something is going on in that barracks, in that prison, in that workplace.
Yeah.
Now, whether there's anything for the HSE to investigate in terms of a particular employer who's disproportionately seeing its subcontractors killing themselves, I have no idea, but that's certainly something that we'd want to know about. It's fairly well documented that one of the contributory factors in poor mental health and even suicide are substance abuse issues. Poor mental health can lead one towards drinking too much, and that can be self-perpetuating, part of a downward spiral, which brings us back to where we started on the topic of alcohol in construction. But
yes,
Do you want to introduce our guest, David?
Yes,
indeed. They've got a different take on all of this. It is worth talking about, I think.
So we're joined today by Adam Nicol, who is director of the HR firm Randstad. And Adam's all about people, you know, working in the HR sector. You know, it's about workplace environments and how people operate within them. Adam, you recently responded in writing for us to a call from the Chartered Management Institute. This is something to do with alcohol in the workplace. And you had some fairly trenchant views on this. And, well, maybe you could just outline what they were for us. Because, first of all, the CMI, what were they saying and what was your response to it?
Well, the CMI have come out and suggested that firms should consider banning alcohol at work events, in essence, is the nub of what their direction of travel would be. And I just think that though there's clear kind of thoughts around why you might have that thought, that opinion these days with so much kind of focus on antisocial behaviour, etc. The truth is you're in danger of throwing the baby out of the bathwater in this one. Now, I completely appreciate that there's an inclusivity piece here. Not everyone, for religious or personal reasons, wants to drink at work events. There's a mental health reason here, and I'm very conscious that there's 500 construction workers a year that suicide each year, and that alcohol is a depressant, and we have to be very cognizant of that. And at Randstad, we do an awful lot of work around that mental health piece in the construction industry. And then, of course, the third caveat is the health and safety, the more kind of immediate health and safety of construction workers who are often, you know, managing machinery and tools that are dangerous, and operating those under the influence of alcohol is a dangerous thing. But, and it's a big but, and actually counter some of the things I've actually said. On the mental health point, there are 9 million people in the country at the moment that declare themselves as lonely, very lonely. And that kind of mental health pandemic is contributing to far more suicide than the potential risks that come from the odd drink, alcoholic drink. And so for that alone, I would kind of counter the view of the CMI. But then if you look at the broader piece here of the social lubricant that alcohol is, and it's team building kind of gold dust, right? And I've tried many, many things over the last 20, 25 years or so to try and get people to bond in the workplace better. And I've yet to come up with anything that's vaguely as effective as the odd drink after work. Other ideas, whether it's, you know, kind of going for breakfast or going for a game of golf or, you know, a kind of one of those breakout rooms that people do, or any kind of, you know, swim or theatre visit, they're all probably less inclusive in some ways, actually, some of them. Not everyone is a sports person. And they're more costly quite often. They're more socially awkward quite often. And they're more expensive quite often, less accessible more often. So a drink after work is kind of much more effective way to bring teams together and oil the wheels of commerce, I suppose. I mean, there's other reasons why I think banning alcohol in working culture would be a bad idea. Economically, it would be horrendous for UK PLC. You know, we're just about dipping under 40,000 pubs right now, and restaurants are closing, you know, plenty a week as well. And it's certainly not the right time now to start kicking one of our biggest industries in the UK. So from an inclusivity perspective, from a cost perspective, from a commercial perspective, from a social lubricant perspective, from a mental health perspective and a team building perspective, I would keep alcohol in the mix, measured alcohol, pardon the pun, in the mix within all industries, and that would include the construction industry.
Well, I mean, I think we all agree that, you know, alcohol is a social lubricant, and it has, it's a valuable tool in that respect. It also, it lowers your inhibitions, doesn't it? And so maybe if you're in a sort of a high pressure working environment, a drink after work, you open up. And I suppose the flip side of that is that if it lowers your inhibitions to an unacceptable degree, then your behaviour suffers. And I mean, we had recently that story with the CBI. Everything blew up at the CBI because of the supposed bad behaviour at various work dues, sexual harassment, and even rape in one occasion. So I mean, it's a fine line, isn't it? Alcohol obviously has a role to play, and I think most of our listeners would agree that a drink after work can only be good as long as it's, as you said, measured. It's when things get out of hand that the harm occurs.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the timing of the CMI's press release just after the CBI's travails there is pertinent here. It isn't one incident, because there will be many incidents of sexual harassment and physical violence at work events. Now, the degree to which that they are influenced by alcohol is, you know, is questionable and up for debate, of course, and those instances are awful. But the cause of those instances, there'll be many causes of those instances. Alcohol may have had a part to play, but you can't come up with policy for the whatever percentage it might be of instances of sexual harassment and physical violence at work events, when 99 point something percent of the time those things don't happen. It would be like, you know, 43,000 people end up in hospital for falling down the stairs every year. 700 of those die. You don't ban staircases because they present a danger to some people. It's we can't go through life thinking that you can mitigate risk out of every instance of life. That road leads to litigious ruin for everyone involved, and it makes life less rich, it makes it less fun, and it's not a society that I personally want to live in. You know, if you just strip out all risk from life, it gets pretty dull pretty quickly.
I think it's easy to overstate. Well, I'll just say for my own experience, I've been known to go to a pub or two, and I've been known to go to a pub or two in a work context. And I have never seen colleagues hit each other or behave particularly bad to each other. I've seen colleagues get to know each other an awful lot better and sometimes end up married. But to me, the biggest risk of alcohol in the workplace is, as David mentioned, it loosens inhibitions. And it does, certainly for me, tend to make me say what I really think, which I might not want the boss always to know.
In vino veritas.
An
interesting point, actually. And one of the points I was going to mention was that, you know, we are a reserved race, famously or infamously, along with other Anglo-Saxon cultures, actually. The Swedes are similar, I think, and the kind of Nordic countries and Germany and stuff. And it is a lubricant in that way. It is a social lubricant, and it does make people be more honest. But there's a good side to that, right? And one can argue that not having that pressure valve kind of outlet to be honest in with work colleagues, but outside of the working environment, i.e. in a pub or a restaurant having a few drinks, is a very effective way to find out what people actually think and what they actually want. And bottling those feelings up for decades on end in the office environment, or indeed in on site or in a hospital or a school or wherever you may work, who's to say that that isn't very unhealthy and may have physical health impacts, let alone mental health impacts? I think alcohol's role in providing an honest platform is arguably one of its strengths. But I mean, I hear the risks for management, certainly. I mean, I've been in situations where I'd wished those around me that are my reports hadn't drunk as much. I've never seen them fight. I've never seen them actually vomit, though I've been aware that one or two of them have gone and vomited somewhere. But would I swap those moments out for the many hundreds slash thousands of moments of true celebration and indeed gratitude for a job well done and a team bonding and feeling part of something. And identity is massive right now. A sense of purpose is massive right now. And we know that teams and the more junior workers in society are seeking purpose. They're seeking identity and they're seeking to belong to something. And actually, one of the best ways to make people feel like they belong is to take them out for a drink. Now, you can argue, well, not if you don't drink, it's not. Well, I could also say that a good half the people under 30 these days probably don't drink alcohol, but they still enjoy going to the pub and mixing it with their friends who may be drinking. They then go on and go to the gym and arguably damage their livers in a different way with a protein shake and 3 hours of pumping iron or whatever. But it still has a very bonding effect on those that go to the pub, whether they drink orange juice or a pint of lager or a bottle of fizz or whatever it might be.
You've touched on something which, while I am slightly on the fence about some of the points you've made, where I absolutely endorse what you say, you touch on the subject of, you talk about bonding, but I think hand in hand and possibly bigger than that is the importance of celebrating wins. And we talked, David and I, at the beginning of our conversation today about the topping out ceremonies and groundbreaking ceremonies and these events that happen on construction sites. And it is important that whether it's a sales success or a project completion or achieving milestones, that you know what success looks like and you shout about it to yourselves, to each other, you know, to the world, and you do properly celebrate success. Now, that may not need to be with alcohol, but it seems like for those who are culturally disposed to do so and can take it, an easy way to celebrate effectively.
Well, absolutely. I read somewhere over the weekend, someone was talking about celebrating success and the role of alcohol. And obviously I knew I was coming onto this podcast, so naturally I read that. And they referenced the Spanish celebrating one of their World Cup wins in the football. I think it's 2010. It was 2010. It's the year I got married. In fact, the day after I got married. And when they won, they celebrated in the streets by honking the horns on the cars and dancing in fountains. And, you know, alcohol wasn't that evident in the streets. And this person talks about how if an Anglo-Saxon country wins a sporting event of that scale, alcohol is a massive part to play in the expression of that celebration. And kind of concluded that it came down to weather, that we're, you know, it's colder, it's darker for much of the year. And so we do kind of hunker down in pubs culturally, have done for, you know, centuries. And that's where we celebrate, because you can't always dance through a water fountain in your shorts when your team wins something. You know, you go to the pub, and I suppose this is cultural, this whole thing, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that, and I don't think there's anything to apologize for that. I think it's important to ensure that people on work events limit their alcohol consumption, and that people are safe, and that the next day we always make sure that people are encouraged to leave the venue late the next morning if it's a residential one, so that they're not driving under the influence, or, you know, have a soft drink every other drink, or stop drinking before midnight to give themselves a good 8-10 hours of kind of non-alcohol in their system before they drive and stuff like that. But so long as those rules are adhered to, then I just think it's a wonderful thing, and I think it's one of the best contributions Britain's ever given to society globally is the pub. I really do. I think it's a tremendous thing. And to remove it and to threaten it, because this would, I mean, you remove drinking from working cultures, that would pretty much do the job of killing the pub in the UK. We're under 40,000. You can Google how many pubs have shut every week. It's hovered between 7 and 11 for at least the last 2.5 decades. Carry on like that. And suddenly, where do you go? Where do you go? when you get married, where do you go when it's Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve? What do you do? You know, because you can't celebrate on Zoom in the same way. You can't bond over a gaming site in quite the same way. And I worry for a society that where younger people are just increasingly unaware of how to communicate with one another in an honest way. You know, mental health concerns of people under 30 are going through the roof, have done for the best part of a decade and a half. They're not good at small talk, broad brush statements here, right? I know, but you know, they are, there's a lot of mental health problems for the younger people. And part of that is because they're not exercising the social muscle, because a lot of their free time is on screens and they're meeting people on screens and they're unhappier because of it. And I'll stand by that one to the nth degree. I've had so many people that worked for me and my teams over the last couple of decades who, if I had to draw a line of those that are less social and those that are most unhappy, the graph is very clear, very, very clear to me. And so I think pubs have a part to play in that and solving that problem.
I think you're absolutely right about the social aspect of it, particularly relating to younger people. And there's no doubt about it that people of my children's generation, people in their 20s and early 30s now, they don't drink the way we did when we were their age. It's not the same sort of thing. Their use of alcohol is far more measured, I think, and perhaps more responsible. But I don't know whether it's connected.
I was going to say, we're saying that's a bad thing. That sounds like, I mean, I'd be quite worried if I had children that did anything, half the things that I got up to.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the hypocrisy.
Precisely,
in all
of course you would. Yeah.
But I agree.
But I mean, I could give you one example. My son works for a company and he works remotely. He works exclusively from home, as do all his colleagues. They don't have a central office. But every month they get together at a different venue with the sole aim of trying to stimulate and create a social network, you know, so these people aren't just sort of, you know, heads and shoulders on a screen somewhere else. They are real people, and they do. And of course, they use alcohol there. They go to a hotel. They stay at a hotel. They have dinner. They go to the bar. They might, you know, the following day, they might go out and do some, you know, I don't know, some kayaking or something like that. But the whole point of it is to combat the loneliness that you mentioned earlier, which is a big problem, I think, especially as I work from home, so does Phil, but I mean, we're of an age where actually we don't want to be in an office with loads of other people anymore. People younger than that, they need that social, that working environment. They need, they're at the beginning of their careers, they need to mix with other people like themselves. And if you can't do it day to day in the office or on site, how are you going to do it?
Well, absolutely. We just did a nationwide A-B test, of course, about the impacts of, you know, not seeing other people for, was it 6 weeks? Lockdown one, and then it kind of rolled on for a year and a half, didn't it? And guess what happened? Everyone got deeply unhappy, and we're still suffering the mental health impact of that one. And you also mentioned earlier, one of you did, about one or two of the people that you worked with ended up marrying people that they worked with. Well, actually, we ran a poll on this one 4 or 5 years ago. Now it's pre-pandemic, but 11% of people, see, it turns out, have married people that they either worked with or they met through a working connection, i.e. they were a supplier or an agency that serviced the company that they worked for. So that's 11% of people that, you know, through the working environment ended up finding the love of their life. And they've got divorced, of course, but that's a different story. If you take that away and you take, you know, because I think alcohol will be a part of that, you know, by definition, that is a social exchange. And for most people, alcohol would have, in this country, it's as true to say that alcohol would have had a part to play in that. If you start removing these social triggers from society, you end up in a kind of Margaret Atwood world of, you know, like The Handmaid's Tale, of people just not interacting, not being able to speak to one another. And I see it now very regularly. The people's fear of networking If I ask people to attend a networking event and try and get hold of 10 contacts by the end of the day, I may as well have asked them to take 17 A levels and get an A grade within the next fortnight, you know, because they're absolutely terrified of that task, that extroverted task. And that's a desperately sad state of affairs. I mean, I think this is potentially the biggest social kind of change in some ways that we've ever seen. I really do think it's pretty desperate.
Right, Adam, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
I estimate that 85% of listeners will be going, at last, someone speaking sense, and 15% of people will be going, that's dreadful, that's terrible. So always good to stir the pot, but I think you'll have most people on your side.
Yeah, well, so. You may be right, you may be wrong, we'll see. I think you make a generational response that's quite different there. I think I'd say that.
I think so.
Well, it's been great talking to you, Adam. Really enjoyed that conversation. It's been very interesting.
Likewise. Thank you, David. Cheers.
Thank you. Well, I thought that was a very stimulating conversation, Phil. And interesting to hear somebody going perhaps against the current orthodoxy to a certain extent. I think a lot of people would agree that he speaks a lot of sense, Adam.
Old school, I think the term
is.
Yeah,
old school, yeah, absolutely. It's very easy to become sort of po-faced and puritanical about these things. I think that a measured approach is always preferable to any of the extremes. So I'm very much middle of the road on this.
David, any other business?
I think I like to talk a load of crap, actually, Phil. I mean, not that I've not been talking crap for the last hour, but I'm sure that all our listeners will have noticed that there's an awful lot of crap going into our waterways and into our beaches, onto our beaches, and the water companies are finally going to do something about it.
Well, only if we give them the money.
Yeah, exactly. They're going to do something about it, but we're going to pay it. Yes, this is a news that I think the water companies, who've got, incidentally, they've got a new chief executive of their trade association, not a trade association, their professional
it
body.
Is. What's it called? It's a trade association, Water UK.
Water UK. Ruth UK. Kelly is the new boss.
Yes.
That's right.
She's the Opus Dei cabinet minister under Tony Blair and Gordon Brown.
That's right.
It seems strange because she was terribly young when she was in the cabinet and sort of disappeared. Now she's still can't be that old, and she's the spokesperson for the water industry.
Yeah.
And she came out, what was it, a couple of weeks ago now, just after our last podcast recording session, that was after we met, saying, we recognise that the 301,000 sewage spills in England alone last year is well, they're not spills, are they? They actually just
open deliberate the gate discharges. And say,
there you go, off you go.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, it's an awful lot of shit.
Certainly is.
Then they're saying, oh, terribly sorry. We must do better. Give us £10 billion, and we'll spend that and give our foreign shareholders masses and masses and masses of dividends.
Yeah.
Profit. There's been quite a lot of commentary in the press and on the radio about this over the past couple of weeks, so I don't think we're us saying it's appalling and they should have done it sooner is going to add anything, but would you like to say it's appalling?
I think it's appalling, yeah. I just want to add my voice to the cacophony of protest. Yeah, of course it is. I mean, the fact that, I mean, Ruth Kelly sounded so pious and sort of hair shirt on the radio a couple of weeks ago, I'm holding my hand up and, you know, we hear you, but then give us £10 billion and we'll fix it. Then I looked into this. There's a chap who's visiting professor of public services or something like that at Greenwich University. He's calculated that water customers are going to pay an extra £624 each by 2030 in order to pay for their water, you know, for the water companies to clean up the waterways and beaches, and it's just not on.
We still have a hosepipe ban.
This chap examined annual dividends paid by companies between 2010 and 2022, which averaged £1.83 billion a year paid to shareholders of water companies. So, I'm not a diehard Labour supporter. I wouldn't say I'm apolitical, in fact, But I think that if there's an industry which is ripe for nationalisation, it's probably the water industry and rail, maybe.
I kind of agree with that. I disagree with the fact that you're apolitical. No one is apolitical. You may not quite know how to vote.
I'm not party political, put it that way.
But, yeah. I accept that. apolitical is, yeah, we are all political. Yeah, man is a political animal.
Yeah.
And that's man with a little M and a U in the middle, as in mankind.
Yep.
Right, David, I've got to get my lunch.
Yes, it's getting near that time, isn't it? Yes. And we've been talking for far too long.
We have. Thank you for listening once again, everyone, and for staying with us for so long. And we will be back again, David and I, in 2 weeks' time, when it really will be summer.
Fingers crossed.
It will, it will. So we'll see you then. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.